This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Timps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking all about family. It's a topic that's hugely important when it comes to mental health, to the kind of support you have, to the kind of upbringing and potential stigma you may soak up. And yet it's something where up till now, we've never had two family members on the show. We often, as you know, generally interview one person, but that relationship is so important between family members. It's massive. Can create such a template for how you deal with other relationships going forward. So today we're super excited with these guests. They are the authors of The Boy Between, which came out just recently on the 1st of November, the first book to explore depression from the perspective of a mother and son. It gives a unique voice to the impact of mental illness on a family, Josh's own incredibly honest account of what it is like to live with depression, and Amanda's heart-wrenching account of her pain watching him suffer and grappling with ways to help him. And actually, our previous guest, Johnny Benjamin, read an early copy of this before we even did and described it as a candid, moving and inspirational book. And it is fascinating the experience they had, but it's also something that's so common. And I think even in the interview, you'll hear how much I relate to it. And a lot of the situations have quite clear parallels to my own experience.
Absolutely. Yeah, you did. We both did, didn't we? We really connected to their story on so many different levels. I think the listeners will too. Amazing, powerful episode.
Yeah. And you'll know behind the scenes, it's something I've been really pushing for, to get more of a parental perspective on mental health. You know, we can so often talk about the stigma from a first person perspective, but it affects all of us. It affects society, it affects groups, it affects families. And so the way in which we navigate that together is also really important.
I never understood until it happened in my family, the huge rippling effect that having an individual in your family experience severe mental illness can have on a family. Never thought about it before. Obviously, if you had to sit down and think about it, people would say, yeah, you know, it must be hard for family members. Like, it goes beyond hard. It's despairingly difficult. And I think for a mother, when it's your child who is an adult, you know, we're not talking about an under 18 person, your life becomes a carer all over again, or never stops. You know, your children grow up, especially when we're talking about, in my case, in my experience, this is somebody with severe mental illness, but his parents should be absolutely living their life now. They're both retired. They love cruise ships. They love holidays. They love life. You know, they're part of a large community that travel and do all different things, and they don't do any of it. Like, their lives have just stopped for the last 20 years, you know?
Part of being a parent is always going to be worry, but it's to a whole different level when you've got mental health to worry about, when you know that they struggle with mental illness. And it's something that I think you're exactly right. You don't often think about unless you're in that situation. And yet it's so common. And I think really we know it's common. I think we've all come across it actually, where you know so-and-so's child is struggling with such and such an illness. And oftentimes we don't ask questions, or we don't want to be seen to pry because we don't want to, you know, come across badly. But actually, I think also some of that can be internalized stigma at times, that sometimes we don't ask because we maybe don't want to know the answer. You know, it's upsetting to hear about, it's hard to hear about, but how much harder is it to be one of those parents and not feel like you can talk about it to people? You know, feel like you've got to just carry on with it silently and do your best. We know how bad it is to be the person struggling directly and feel the stigma that you can't speak up. But also that affects whole families then as well. And there can be a lot of shame that can be attached to that, that's completely wrong. That people can feel, oh, this is somehow a reflection of me that they're struggling. And of course it's not. And I think you hear a little bit of that with contrast, with Amanda talking about how she thought about certain things at the time. And now looking back on it, feels so guilty for how she reacted. But, you know, that's genuine. That's how it was. And that is how it is for so many people. And in particular, the situation was specific to them. There is so much that's common with it. You know, Josiah was struggling whilst he was at university. About 2 million students in the UK right now. And they're dealing with surely the most stressful year that education has ever seen. You don't know if your exams are happening. You don't know if you can go to uni. Am I going to get to uni and then be immediately put into lockdown? Am I going to see my parents at Christmas? These are questions that we never had to even consider when we were in education. And now a situation that can so often be stressful just has a whole other level. And so I found some info on that actually from a student living site that gives some advice in terms of mental health. So they described that even global events aside, student mental health and anxiety is already a significant issue across the country. The most extensive study ever done on the topic found that 1 in 5 students suffer from a mental health issue, with depression and anxiety topping the list. Plus, 1 in 3 students have experienced an issue for which they felt the need to get professional help. And the statistics also indicate that 33% of students often or always feel lonely. And that last one really hit me because, of course, we've talked about it loads recently. Loneliness is having a spotlight on it right now. It's not a new issue, but it's one that's exacerbated and increased right now. And yet, even still, the stereotypes. So often we think loneliness, we think of elderly. We don't think of students being lonely. We don't think of them going off to university life and being lonely. We think of homesickness, but it's all linked.
Absolutely. And students get a bad rap in general. And people, you know, assume and perceive that all students are, you know, going out drinking in the first year, not doing their studies, not eating properly and whatever they're doing and just having a great time. There are a lot of students that really do struggle to transition into university life. And there are also a lot of students, even during this lockdown, something interested me when, you know, looking at all these students like hanging out the windows of their halls and being like, yeah, we're missing home and we're missing, you know, we want to be out, we're not enjoying, it's hard, but we're getting food parcels and seemingly okay. But, you know, and they've kind of formed these, probably have become quite tight and been forced to get to know each other quickly. And that's probably great for the majority, but there will be some who are absolutely really, really struggling, that aren't forming friendships that well, do not feel comfortable in the halls that they're in, potentially may have moved out if they weren't on lockdown, want to maybe get their work done and everybody else isn't, and they're all, you know, doing what they're doing. Felt so, I was drawn to thinking about, what about those that are just in the back room, you know, those that are really feeling isolated and really struggling with this? Because I reckon the majority of students are getting through this. They're quite resilient. They're getting on with it. They're finding new ways. It's all quite novel. It's probably quite fun for some of them for the short term. But there'll be so many that, you know, it really isn't that fun for. And I'm not sure they're, you know, the light's being shone on them actually as much as it should be.
Yeah, and I totally get it. All the ones that are putting off starting uni, that are having a year out, I totally get it, because it's just whatever the restrictions are for your area, it's not going to be the university experience you expected. And even what you said about like these kind of perceptions of how students are, even that can go hand in hand with mental health problems. Mm-hmm. You can be the bubbly, outgoing one that always seems happy. That doesn't always mean you are happy. It can be too easy to learn to put on that front when you're struggling with your mental health. That can in itself be a symptom that you're faking emotions. Your fake happiness can be a symptom of your depression, for example.
And absolutely.
We don't often think about it. And it all links back, like we said, to family. You know, right now, my sister's just gone back to do her master's. She went to her new home. She doesn't know the people she's living with yet. And then a week later, Sheffield's in tier 3 restrictions. And so, of course, my first instinct is text her, check she's okay. But every family's different. And certainly not being able to see your family isn't going to make it any easier to keep that, you know, that support and keep that connection.
And I think you've made a good point by bringing up students when we talk about this and with family and mental health, because the guests on, you know, Josiah was really wanting to live up to expectations, really, of himself and his family. And I think Amanda even addressed that, you know, in terms of where they're from, their background, their friends, you know, their whole world was, it almost was assumed, you know, there's so many families that where it's just assumed that you'll go to university and that you're bright throughout school. So then you'll do your A levels and then you'll go to university. And then imagine you're a kid who's just in your mind, like struggling with despair and this dark depression. There's this cloud and this weight over you, but you're expected to smile and you're expected to be, yeah, I'm fine. And I think we know how hard that is in adulthood. You know, imagine when that is in that situation, when that transition, those really formative years, 16, 17, 18, when that happens and you're supposed to be doing your A-levels and going off to uni and being great and integrating and having fun and doing well in your studies, and you don't want to ring home and say, I haven't been to lectures for a month. I can't get out of bed. I've been in bed all day and all night for having eaten. You know, the despair. And I just think that the guests were brilliant and so open, and you know, we were so grateful that they shared their story, weren't we? Because it must, you know, must happen so often, and it's not spoke about hardly enough.
Oh, for sure. So I'm glad to get that spotlight on it, but also so much of this connects to family in general. They have worked through it together to become an incredible example of what great family support can be. Great communication, great openness. And, you know, that goes always, you know, so now Amanda can feel more able to be honest with Josiah about how she's feeling as well. You know, it's not just all about supporting the kid. You know, a communicative family is a good family to me, particularly when these issues are so common. And so we'll just kind of end up with one more stat related to that, actually. This is from the World Health Organization, who report that globally more than 264 million people experience depression, and it is a leading cause of disability. So the impact there is huge. And I know particularly at the moment, we can get a bit numb to statistics. A million spent on this, a million cases here, and but, you know, 264 million, wow. And that is not a statistic from this year. So we would only expect that to have risen.
And that's cases. That's for people that have been to the doctors and have been diagnosed, not for all of the other millions who haven't, who are living with it.
Of course, that is what it is based on. Also, I just wanted to mention a link. If you do relate to the experience of this, do check out the World Health Organization. They've got some great resources. Oh, and that's one thing I've just remembered, actually. I've got a stat from the article, which I'll link, that gives that advice for student living on different things that you can do to support your mental health at the moment. And one of the pieces was to call home. And they reported that around 35% of Brits think the coronavirus will end up bringing the world closer together. There's no better time now to chat with family. So set up a chat with your loved ones back home to catch up and help you feel more connected.
Aww.
So I thought that was a nice place to finish up with, referencing the coronavirus again, these potential positives that we see.
Yeah, that's lovely.
So with that all said, we'll get into the episode with Amanda Prowse and Josiah Hartley in a moment. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
I'm Amanda Prowse, and I think the first time I became aware that mental health was even a thing was when my mum invited her friend and her son for dinner. I think it must have been about 7 or 8. And she explained to us that he had mental health issues. He was suffering with addiction and he was in a pretty bad way. And I can remember being petrified and sitting across the table looking at this clearly struggling figure and thinking, oh, well, I definitely don't want that. That's really scary. I would hate that to be me. I think I was too little to understand, but certainly as I got older, yes, massively, I have always felt deeply afraid of mental illness. I thought it was what happened to other people. I thought it wouldn't happen to me or my family because I didn't know. I thought it was a particular set of circumstances that led to a collapse in mental health. I was so poorly informed, and I feel desperately ashamed and embarrassed about my ignorance because I'm 52. And it's taken until my 40s, really, to understand that it can and does happen to anyone, and that it can happen for a million reasons, or it can happen for no reason, just like becoming ill with anything else. For a large part of my life, I avoided the topic because I didn't want to know about it. I was afraid of it.
Thanks so much for sharing that. It's interesting hearing that contrast of how you thought at the time and how you think about that experience years later, decades later. But I do get it, you know, as much as we campaign against the stigma, I understand that it is scary. And I understand that from a first person perspective as well, with my own experiences, it is scary. I worry about getting ill again. I worry about maintaining a certain level of mental health I've fought to achieve now, and if that may dip. But you're quite right, it's also to do with understanding that we can have this misguided notion, if we don't know any better, that it's something almost like a horror movie where if you talk about a thing, it happens.
I think also for my generation, certainly there was shame around it. I remember one of our family members' friends having a mental breakdown and it ended up being sectioned. And there was a lot of hushed talk around that. It was a whispered thing. It wasn't something that was spoken about openly, you know, like every other topic that would fly back and forth across the dinner table. This wasn't one of them. So I think I kind of learnt that it was something that made you feel a little bit ashamed. And again, that reaction from me makes me feel very ashamed. And, you know, I'm horrified by that now. I'm older and I understand exactly what goes on, but I think that's how I grew up.
Right, and that's the journey we all have to go on when the stigma is still prevalent and the understanding isn't yet where it should be and we hope it will reach. So that's something Danielle and I can relate to as well, having to really come to terms with how big the gaps in our understanding was. And we still, to an extent, come across that today. There are themes we cover which we're embarrassed how new they are, you know, that we don't quite have an idea of what to say yet, but that's an important journey and one that we're lucky to go on with our listeners. For you, mental health really came crashing into your life, from what I understand. And Josh, do you mind sharing where your journey with it began?
Yeah, of course. I can't think of the first incident where the word mental health was used, but I certainly think it was around fifth form at school, lower sixth, where my own mental health started to decline. So that was when it became very personal for me, and not something that happened to other people. The beginning stage of depression, very hard to describe because it's so subtle at first. It's that the subtlety of just colours in the world fading ever so slightly and a feeling less range of emotion than before. And it's so subtle at first, you don't notice it sneaks up on you. That was my first personal experience with mental health.
Yeah, very true and very honest. And that's certainly something I experienced, living with depression from a very young age and just not knowing what it was until years later when I got much worse. What was happening in your life as your symptoms began to develop?
At least initially, my school life was pretty similar to how it always had been. But my home life, I was sleeping more often than I wasn't. I was getting in from school and sleeping. You know, my weekends were spent sort of recharging my batteries. I think we used to call it a lot more in the house. But looking back, that was a sign of early stages of depression.
And it's interesting that you mentioned there the sleeping more, because that's something I think can be so overlooked for teenagers, that there's so often this writing off of what can be genuine symptoms of struggling. But we think, oh, well, teenagers are troubled, or teenagers sleep a lot, or they're meant to be grumpy. And at the time, was that something that you just thought a lot of this was?
It didn't really seem, well, your normal is your normal. And it didn't really seem that extraordinary, my life at that time. Looking back, I can see there are a lot of signs that weren't quite right there. But at the time, it just felt normal.
And in addition to that, were there any other symptoms that were coming up for you?
My physical health deteriorated slightly, I'd say. I had quite a lot of aches and pains, which I think didn't help, but they weren't directly related to depression.
Can I ask you, Joshy? I don't want to put words in your mouth, but Josh was an A-grade student, and suddenly his interest in his schoolwork, in his academic life, everything just dropped away. He went from being this high flyer to doing absolutely nothing. I don't know if that was a symptom of...
Yeah, that was slightly later in A-levels, yeah.
And when that was happening, were you both worried about it, or would you say one of you noticed that more?
I think I initially hid it from my parents to begin with. They thought I was studying for my A-levels at the time, and I wasn't doing anything. My existence was mainly spent asleep, to be honest with you. I think when you found out, I think you were concerned. And we had a big debate, actually, if I was going to sit my A-levels or not. I sat them doing literally no work, which was detrimental to mental health. We decided on the morning of my A2s if I was going to sit them or not.
I remember Josh, we'd always said to Josh and Ben, both of our boys, we don't mind what you do. We don't mind who you are, what path you take in life. There's only two things that you have to promise us. One is that you'll go out in the world and talk to as many people as you can, because that's how we all get to know each other and we build a wonderful community and make you a good citizen of the planet. And the other thing is, don't ever lie to us about anything. There's nothing you can tell us, nothing that will bother us or upset us. Just never tell us a lie. So it never occurred to me that Josh might be lying to us, because he told me he wouldn't. And I believe my boys. So when I would say, are you working? And he'd say, yep. And is everything okay? He'd say, yes. I know it sounds very naive, and I was naive. It didn't occur to me that Josh was actually not doing those things. He'd started to unravel, and we didn't see it because he was in his room all the time, just like he used to be when he was studying. So I'd walk into a room and he would be tip-tapping on a laptop or, you know, saying, well, I'm just going to have a little nap. And I'd think, oh gosh, you know, he's exhausted, bless him. He's really hitting the books. And he became quite expert at hiding a lot of the red flags and symptoms that now I know to look for. But I didn't know I should be looking for those things. I didn't expect it and I didn't see it. And sometimes when you're very close to something, you don't see it. And partly I think I didn't want to see it. And so it was easy for me to make out it wasn't happening and for Josh to disguise what was happening.
Right. And I think this is also a reflection in a way of your closeness, that you understood what the other was looking for. Josh wanted to come across that he was working and he was doing the things that you expected and being honest, and you just cared about him being happy. And so you're both trying to actually look after the other's interests. But in doing so, there's not that dialogue there.
Absolutely right. There was no dialogue. And I think that was the thing that enabled depression to properly take a hold. And by the time I think I realised what was going on with Joshy, it had come to live in our house. And when depression comes to live in your house, it doesn't stay in one room. It has a snaking tendril that goes into every brick, every crevice, every cupboard, every corner. And so before we knew what was happening, like a creeping ivy, we were all covered and we were all being strangled by it. And by that stage, we went straight from happy to panic. And then I went straight into find a solution, fix him, because I'm his mum and that's what I have to do. And I think we missed out an awful lot of stages had I understood and got involved earlier on. I think that's fair to say, Josh, where I think maybe it would have been a more collaborative approach to his getting better or his healing, finding a way to live a good life with depression. I think that would have come a lot quicker had we both been a lot more honest with exactly what we were worried about and what we were going through.
And I love the really descriptive metaphors you use there, because that is what it's like, that kind of creeping sensation. And it bleeds into so much that it can be difficult to separate what is depression and what is who you are. And that's something that I've definitely got a lot of experience of growing up, thinking that I was a sad and lonely kid. And that was that. And if you think that's who you are, of course, you're just going to adapt with that. And you realize that the adults around you are happier when you pretend to be happy as well, or you have to have a reason to be sad. Was that something that you experienced as well, Josh?
Yeah, I think so. Luckily, I'm glad to say I think it is slightly better than it was, say, 5 years ago. But I didn't fully know what was happening to me. I think one of depression's sneakiest tricks, it makes you feel like you're the only one who has suffered in this way. And it's quite a unique feeling. And the unfortunate truth is, there's probably multiple people on your street feeling that way right now, but you'd never think that. That's one of its nastiest tricks, is making you feel just isolated from everything, feeling like you're the only one. It's just horrific. That's why just speaking about and getting this dialogue out there is so important right now.
Definitely. You just don't know what's going on behind the scenes for people. And like you've said, oftentimes you don't really realise for yourself that these issues can develop quite gradually. And so there isn't often that clear point of, I was doing okay and now I'm ill. There is no sudden change. And so it can feel easier to go along with it and pretend that things are okay and do your best to get by and sort of, I guess, put up and shut up to a certain extent. And then often the actual breaking point is when you're far further into it and there is no pretending you're okay anymore. Do you feel like that was a point you reached?
Yeah, absolutely. It was, I think it's fair to say, reached an inevitable crescendo. At that stage in my life, there was no way I could have avoided that. And that partly came from my own ignorance about the illness, I think. When you're in crisis point with depression, it's almost impossible to get better by yourself. So you do need to let people in at that stage.
Could you describe the kind of build-up of how you were feeling and how the condition developed?
I felt more and more isolated from the world. I felt like my flat was almost in a different time stream to the rest of the city I was living in. Day or night had very little relevance on my existence. And I remember I observed day and night. I used to think, oh, it's daytime and nighttime now. But when things fell into proper crisis mode, it just was irrelevant. At one point, I didn't leave my bed for anywhere between 5 days and 2 weeks. I just completely lost track of time.
Wow. And at this point, where were you in terms of worry about yourself?
I think I was beyond worrying about myself. I'm not sure I was capable of worrying about myself at that stage. I think I was beyond that. I think my family were capable of worry, but for my own personal well-being, that was out the window at that point.
And was that, at this point, beginning to affect how you felt towards yourself?
It's odd to say now, but I barely recognised myself at that point. Even physically in the mirror, I was so dishevelled, I almost looked like a caricature, a monsterised version of myself at that point. I felt like I wasn't welcome in society and not mentally able to go out into society. Even things like popping to the shop were impossible for me at that stage.
Yeah. Did you find then that was affecting not just your perception of those abilities, but also your confidence in yourself and how you felt in terms of liking yourself?
It would have been hard to get much worse at that stage, how I felt about myself. So it's definitely, but that period happened slightly faster, I think. I think I went from being a relatively normal student to being completely isolated at the start. When I was still living at home before uni, I think the onset of depression was more gradual. But when I was sort of at uni and living by myself is when the decline can happen a lot.
And I went through a very similar experience myself and I ended up dropping out. But within the space of just a term, I went from being relatively high functioning and able to pretend like I was fine and people believed in how happy I came across, which is weird to sort of contemplate because I didn't actually want to be at university right from the start. And yet people were quite happy to go along with the idea that I did want to be there, that maybe that was easier than the truth. And then before long, I was in that similar place of just going to the shop downstairs. Felt like such a distance.
Yeah, yeah. And it's funny you say that because you just don't know what's going on behind closed doors. I'm sure if you'd met you on a night out or at a party, you might have seen like one of the happiest blokes in the room. But in reality, you know, that's far from the case. From what it sounds like, right. I don't know your personal experience.
No, you're right. And it's a practice that I think we do that we're used to. And it's part of the stigma, putting on this mask and feeling that mental health needs to be justified. And at the time, I did feel like that. I felt that in comparison to what other people were going through, I had no right to complain or feel like how I did. And that feels somehow productive at the time, but it only serves to make you feel worse.
Yeah, absolutely. It just adds that sense of isolation. One of the worst feelings in the world is feeling completely alone in a crowded room, I think.
And in anticipation of going off to uni, Amanda, were you worried about his ability to thrive in that environment, given what you'd seen so far?
Yeah, I was. I mean, I don't think I fully understood what Josh was going through. And I remember looking on the Samaritan's website to look up the definition of depression. I didn't want to use the word because I didn't want that to be the flag that Josh nailed to his mask. I didn't want him to be a person like that. I had a very strong image in my head of what someone with depression was like. I'd only ever heard people say, I live with depression. I battle depression. I'd never heard anyone said, I had a bit of depression and now I'm great. And so I didn't want that to be what was wrong with my son. I didn't want him to have that illness. And I avoided looking at the word and I avoided talking about it because I thought that might make it real. And I don't say that with any element of pride. I say it with a great deal of shame, because once I understood that that is exactly what Josh had, because when I looked at the symptoms, it was almost like everything it stated, you know, a loss of appetite, a loss of interest in your physical being, isolation, sleeping, everything. It was just everything was Josh, and I couldn't sort of shy away from it anymore. And I remember saying to him one day, I was cooking actually at the kitchen, I remember it, and I said, oh, Josh, I said, I was reading about someone who thought they had depression. And it sounded a little bit like what you're going through. Do you think you might have that? Because I didn't know how to start the conversation. I didn't want it to be our reality. And I turn round and Josh is, you know, he's over 6 foot. He's a big lad. And he was sat there and he was crying like a child. And I'll never, ever forget it, seeing him sitting there with You know, when someone cries from within rather than their eyes, and it was these big tears falling down his face, and he said, "Oh, you think?" And I thought, oh my gosh, so how long have you known this? How long have you been thinking this? And have I now made it real? And then I realised Josh was people like that. Josh had this illness. He was suffering with depression. And then, of course, I didn't know what to do with that information. So where do I go for the cure? Where's the magic tablet? Where's the retreat? Who's the doctor? What's the book we read? Where's the place we go to make everything better? So even though I then understood what he was suffering with, there was a name for my child's illness, which made me feel at the same time a lot better, but also absolutely petrified. I then went straight into fix it solution mode. How do I fix Josh? How do we fix it? What's best for him? As though it was my battle and I could make it better. Like, you know, a sweeper in curling that goes ahead on the ice, getting all the little bubbles out of the way to make a smooth glide path. That's what I wanted to do for my son. And I couldn't do it. And I now know I can't do it. But that was the start, really, of my journey, my understanding. And I remember Josh saying to me, the fact that you don't know what to do and the fact that you don't understand it and you're the person that loves me the most makes me feel even more alone. And I was absolutely devastated because I'm his mum and I'm the one that has been able to fix everything, you know, to a degree. And the fact that I couldn't and I was helpless to do that, it was the worst feeling in the world. It still is.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that, because it's so true that no mother wants her child to experience mental illness, but particularly when you've heard such a damning account of it, you know, like you said about a flag or a stamp, that this was something that you felt if he got labelled with it, then that's it. It's some kind of damning diagnosis. To an extent, my mother went through something similar with my dyslexia when I was younger, that she was seeing so many of the signs, but then at the same time thinking, but his life will be so much harder if this is true. So I really hope it's not.
So I don't know if you can hear me laughing here. I'm not laughing at your story. I'm laughing because Josh is severely dyslexic. And I remember that conversation with the teacher. And she said, he's unlikely to be able to write his own name, she said to me at one point. And I remember thinking, how does a boy like that live in this world, where everybody's reading and writing, where everything's written, how does my son function properly in that environment? And I know exactly what your mum's talking about. I'd like to talk to your mum, Bobby.
I'm sure she'd love that. The reason I mention it is because it's that really difficult balance of you want to support and connect with your child, but you're also worried for them. But then you can't put that worry on them, right? Because I was already struggling with dyslexia. That was the reality. And so there wasn't a worry your way out of it option. And it sounds like you got trapped in that same space.
Very much so. And I think I did that for years, just trying to throw anything I could, my time, reading, try and understand it, anything I could throw at it to try and fix it. But of course, I can't. It's not my battle. And I will never understand it because I haven't lived it. I can understand what Josh is going through, and I understand how to help him with his symptoms, and I understand what his life is like. Like with any other long-term illness, I understand how he has to live and how I can make, you know, situations and an environment that will ease his day-to-day living. But I'll never understand it because it's not my lived experience.
Yeah, no, that's true. But I think that's a really important thing to acknowledge, right? And that's the way to shift that back, you know, to take yourself out of the pressure of the worrying and I have to have the answer, and instead back onto someone that wants to be listened to and acknowledged. And that sounds a little bit like what you described of bringing the word depression up for the first time and Josh reacting so strongly to that, of that was the connecting, that you can tell me if this is true, but I imagine you might have felt what your mum was going through, that there were certain things that weren't being talked about, certain questions that weren't being asked. So to have that word brought up may have been a massive relief of, okay, the door's open, I can now be a bit more honest.
It was both, because I was aware all her actions were coming from a place of love, but it's like when people say, just go for a walk, walk it off, you know, talk about it. That's great in some instances, but it just shows how disconnected she was from what I was going through at that stage, because all these suggestions were great and they were genuinely coming from a place of love, but it's just made me feel even more alone. I'm not capable of going, and it seems silly now, of getting on a plane and sitting on a beach for a week. If you're not suffering depression, that sounds great and that might lift up your spirits, but it's not going to get you out of depression. But once the depression dialogue had started, I was acutely aware of how my mood was affecting my parents. And living under the same roof as someone with depression isn't always the easiest thing. At the same time, eventually, I knew I had to get better for them as well as myself. Because when you no longer care about yourself, it's caring for the other people that can sort of help kickstart the recovery a little bit.
Yeah, that's so true. And such an antidote to the loneliness that you describe, that you can feel like you're holding all of that in. And so then to have someone actually enter into the dialogue that's swirling around in your head can feel incredibly freeing. When your mum described that experience of mentioning depression to you that first time, do you remember how you were feeling at the time?
Absolutely. I think it was such a visceral response. It was almost subconscious in a way. It was just a release that I had very little control over. But I remember that day very vividly. It was nice and it was great to have that word out in the open. But at the same time, all the connotations that came with it were frightening initially.
And had that been something you'd considered for a while at that point, that this may be what you're going through?
I'd say the symptoms of depression had been going on within me for a while, but the sort of acceptance that I had depression was relatively new for me at that stage still, I think. It's easy on the outside looking in, but it's when you're the one going through it, it's harder. But I had accepted I had depression at that point in the kitchen where depression was first used. I just started university at that point.
Right. And so as you settled into the university experience, how did you find the depression developed and how bad did it get?
I think at school, you're in such a sheltered environment. You miss one lesson and you immediately, where were you? And like at uni, I realised you could miss a week and nobody cared. And that was initially extremely freeing, but it's also a trap to fall down into. Because when you realise no one cares if you're there or not, it's partly hard to feel wanted. And it's partly like you've got release, you can just fall and there's no one there to catch you, which is freeing, but it's also scary at that period.
Josh was at Southampton Uni and his decline was fairly sharp and he planned to take his own life, which we were completely unaware of. It's still even saying that to you feels so alien to me because we love him so much and we will, you know, we think he's an amazing person. He's a really lovely, kind person with a huge sense of justice, and the idea that he couldn't see any beauty in the world, couldn't feel anything and felt his best option was to not be here anymore is such a hard concept to try and understand. But Josh bought some pills and planned to end his life, and I was working in Australia for a couple of weeks and Josh had stopped answering his telephone, and my husband just got a feeling, and he says he doesn't know why. He just got a feeling. He can't put it down to any more than that. He said, I just woke up and thought, And he drove from our home in just outside Bristol to Southampton. And we now know that Josh had the tablets in his hand, pretty much. And by the time he found Josh, he was living in a very, very bad way.
Sort of all self-care had gone out the window at that point. I was living completely by myself. I was just completely isolated. My sheets hadn't been washed in, I can't remember, months and months and months. I hadn't showered in weeks. I was either just asleep or staring at the ceiling, and that was it. That was my entire existence. It's hard to say now, but I remember when the pills I ordered arrived on my welcome mat and the sort of relief that they granted me, because they were a way out of this state of living that I felt was just never ending, which is hard to say now. It was sort of a way out of just a situation I couldn't see ending.
Yeah, I can see that. Whilst I didn't get to being actively suicidal when I was dealing with depression at university, I can certainly relate to that feeling that there was no way out, that I was on a path that I did not want to be on. And I could see my very sense of who I was slipping away. So what you said about not recognizing yourself anymore, I can, 100% relate to that, because whilst you were in an environment where maybe it was easy for certain people, even beyond your family, to think that things might not have been as bad, you know, he's off to university, it's an exciting new chapter in your life. That's not necessarily an exciting new chapter for everybody. That spiral that you describe can be easy to fall down, because at times it can feel like you're doing the right thing, that maybe people don't want to be around me, so I am better living on my own. and maybe people would be better off if I wasn't around, because you've lost so much of the value in yourself. You know, if you can't see it, you then assume no one else can.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great way of putting it.
And so when your dad arrived, what happened then?
I remember his face actually when he saw my living conditions. It was quite obvious that something wasn't right. And he was aware I was suffering with depression, but you know, that's quite a wide scope. You know, people live with depression and still work a 9-to-5. And there's people who have depression who literally can't get out of bed. So when he saw me, I remember his face. It was shocked. Immediately sort of looked around. It was fairly squalid looking back. He held my hand and I went to sleep. He was just there for me, saying, you know, it's all going to be okay. You're coming home with me, which I didn't initially want to go home with him. But I am grateful now that I didn't have a choice in that matter. When I woke up, he was cleaning up some of the rubbish, putting my clothes in a bag, and we drove home. I was grateful for his presence.
And by contrast, do you remember when you weren't picking up the phone, what the thought process behind that was?
I think at some points it was just an annoyance. It was just almost hanging up as quick as possible, just like, nope. And then eventually just turned my phone off. And at that point, there was, like I say, day and night had no meaning or relevance to my life. I was sleeping so much and in bed, I'd say 23 to hours a day minimum. So it was all sort of just what anybody else was doing was sort of relevant. I remember at some points, looking back, these were slightly better days, actually, it being 4 a.m. and thinking, what a great time, because I knew nobody was going to call. There was nothing expected of me at that moment. I could just lie there and stare at the ceiling in perfect peace, which it's quite odd to say now, looking back.
I do get that, though. Do you think that was the link then, that speaking to your family felt like a kind of pressure, that even just that conversation was more than you thought you could live up to at the time?
Yeah, absolutely. I was having so little contact with the outside world. It was mainly with family through the phone.
Yeah. And that's tough, because they're the people that most of the time care about you so intensely and would understandably be really worried about you. So then what do you do? You know, do you lie to them because you want them to feel okay and not to worry and be upset? Or are you honest and then they're upset anyway? And then so are you, probably.
Yeah. It's incredibly hard. I know I lied to them at that stage and said it was quite brief answers that I'm fine, all good, you know, everything's okay, even though it was far from it in reality. But I think after I moved back to Bristol, after that incident, is when I started being more open and truthful. And that's when I was acutely aware of the effect my illness had on them, because it was so out in the open at that period. You know, I think the dialogue did open up and we were both more honest to each other. And there was one incident where I got blackout drunk and fell through a window.
Mm-hmm.
And that was sort of a real crescendo. But it was aware that my illness was affecting my parents to such a degree that we just couldn't have gone on the way we were. So from that day onwards, it was in the front of my mind that I had to get better for all of us.
So on one hand, Josh is home and you get to be around and try and look after him, but it's so difficult at the same time.
Even though his plan to take his life had been foiled, that actually wasn't the hardest time. The hardest time came after for us, because Josh took to his bed and was self-medicating with alcohol. So he was either, you know, when he did go out and socialise or see his friends, or which was very rare, he would get extremely drunk, which was a real concern for us. We didn't really know how to handle that. And part of us was delighted that he was actually out and seeing people. But I think we realised he was only going out so that he could drink very, very heavily. And I was worried he might hurt himself. And then he did hurt himself. And I don't think I'm speaking out of turn, Josh, say if I am, but it was horrific. And he was undecided whether to seek help or just bleed out, basically. And Josh's friend found him and took him to A&E. And when we got that call, it made me realise that we hadn't actually turned any corners. We were exactly where we were all those weeks before, all those months before, where Josh was still undecided as to whether he wanted to be here. And we were still scrabbling around like busy fools trying to fix. We didn't even know what we were trying to fix, to be honest, Bobby. We were just into like full action mode, you know, what do we do, and keeping an eye on him. And I can remember we had a little house with a small landing and all the bedrooms just off one, you know, one little corridor. And I felt really guilty sleeping, because I could hear him clicking the light on and off, or, you know, listening to a podcast, or moving around on the bed, or crying, or having a drink, or but just in the early hours. And all I wanted for him was for peace and sleep. And he just felt so, I felt so unable to help him. We didn't know what to do. We said, do you want to talk to someone? Can you see a doctor? And Josh, at that point, sort of point blank, refused to really see anyone outside the house. He didn't want to go to his GP. And we were absolutely out of answers. And then on the night when he hurt his wrist, we all, as a family, we unraveled. My husband collapsed and I pretty much collapsed on top of him. And we were just on the floor in a heap, physically beaten, because we didn't know what to do next. We didn't know how to help Josh. Two things happened that night. First of all, I realised I had to be brave enough to say to him, are you thinking of taking your own life today? Because then if he ever said yes, I could put in a strategy that would try and delay that and try and get us the window of opportunity just to keep Josh here for another minute, another hour, another day. In a way, that was the start of us all as a family learning how to live and deal with Josh's illness. And also, it was the first time I think Josh fully saw a physical representation of what living in a house with this bearing down on us. And don't get me wrong, we always remind ourselves, no matter how bad it is for us, it is a million times worse for Josh. And when we are hurting, he then has that as another layer of pressure. So it's walking that tightrope between being open enough to start dialogue, but wary that actually that dialogue might feel more than he can cope with. It was like walking on a tightrope, but the tightrope's on fire. And someone's throwing rocks at your head.
I can see that. And you're right, it's so tough. But also, that is such a clear turning point. And I'm so glad that you've mentioned about asking if he was feeling suicidal. Because that's something, when I used to work for the Samaritans, we were trained in. Because the default is to avoid that subject altogether. And I think all of us grow up with a certain fear that that is something that if you talk about it, you'll give people ideas. And in fact, what I've found and what the research shows is that you are rarely thinking of that for the first time with someone that's really struggling, and you contemplate it to different levels as your condition deteriorates. And so there actually can be something very empowering about asking that question. If you really feel that that's what someone's going through, if you can take away the stigma and the worry that you feel, and actually think about how they're feeling right now, that can be incredibly validating, because you're seeing how bad things are. You're acknowledging that.
I think also, Bobby, it was the start of being truthful. It was the start of being really truthful with each other, of me being able to look Josh in the eye and say, every time you're quiet, every time you're late in, every time you don't answer your phone, I worry that you've taken your life. And for him to be truthful and say, you know what, today that's not going to happen. And it was actually a really healthy, wasn't it, Josh? I think it was like almost like ripping off a sticking plaster that we should have done a long time ago. But it's exactly what you said. I thought if I mentioned it, I might make it happen, which was scary.
Yeah, for sure. And in the same way, Josh would have been hiding throughout this how bad things were at times, or certain symptoms. You were also hiding your fear. And so both of you are shutting down the conversation. And so, of course, it feels like this incredibly massive gap. Idea of almost like a vortex in the house that everyone can see, but if anyone acknowledges it, it might just eat us all up.
Yeah, I describe it as a monster that used to sit on the end of my bed, and I could see it at 3 a.m. and stand behind me in the mirror when I was cleaning my teeth. And I felt like it was a battle between me and him, and we were both pulling Josh, and I wasn't going to let go, but I knew they weren't going to let go either. And I just wondered how long we could all live like that.
And during this time, Josh, do you remember what it was like when this dialogue started?
Scary initially, but a real turning point in my life and all of our lives, I'd say, it's fair to say. But it was up until we had that honest and open dialogue, I don't think I was making progress. I don't think I was improving. And I think path out of severe depression is so slow and gradual. You don't really notice it until you're already, I don't want to say out of the woods, but you're so far from where you've originally came, but you don't notice it because it is so subtle. No one wakes up and think, oh, I don't have depression anymore. But 2-3 months down the line, you think, you know what? The colours have started to come back. I see more in myself. You recognise yourself in the mirror a bit more. It's little things, but just the world in general seems a bit brighter.
At that point, you'd gone so long hoping this would pass. And nobody wants it to go more than the person that's experiencing it. And that can be something that's missed. As someone that cares about a person living with depression, it can seem from the outside like they're not interested in progress. But actually, what you don't see is that they're treading water. They're trying really hard to just even be stable.
And I think that must be frustrating for carers who haven't gone through it before, knowing that they're doing all they can and that progress isn't being made. But it's when all your energy that you say is being put into treading water, that is progress. Just if someone's in crisis, just staying, it doesn't feel like it, but just staying here for another day is an achievement. Hour by hour, day by day, things can and often do get better. You do just have to hang in there.
Right. That's something that my counsellor says to me all the time, that sometimes survival is enough. Survival can be progress.
Yeah, it sounds great. That message needs to get out there more than it already is.
Definitely. And do you remember when things began to get better for you? What did that look like?
Well, I still suffer from bad days and good days, but there's a lot more good days than bad right now, I'm thankful to say.
Sorry, I was going to say, I think the pressure was lifted from you when we said, just don't go to university, just don't go. It doesn't matter. None of it matters. No piece of paper, no qualification, no job, no role, no social media likes. Nothing matters as much as your mental health, as finding peace and crawling into that bed at night and sleeping and wanting to wake up the next morning. That's the only thing that matters. Just leave, don't do it. I personally noticed a difference in Josh's demeanour physically, in every sense, really, when we had that conversation. I don't know if that's fair, Josh.
Yeah, that is fair. I felt there was no other option. I had to go to university. I had to get a degree. And when that was off the table, I did feel a massive weight off my shoulders.
Yeah, and it must have felt like one less thing that you were failing at.
Yeah, absolutely. It was one less thing to think about. I don't have to go to university. It was a scary time because I just did not know what was next for me. But it was, as we say, at one point in my life, all I could see in front of me was just darkness, just unpleasantness, just this state that just wasn't going to end. But after dropping out of university, I could see a bend in the road and I couldn't see my future. And that doesn't sound that comforting, but it was, because I knew it was almost a break in my future that could have been led to anything rather than what I knew was just pure misery.
Right. And almost like a pause that you needed to just reset and get back to what you actually needed, as opposed to feeling like you're on this kind of treadmill you can't live up to. And in addition to that pressure coming off, was there support you got as well as your family?
I got two dogs, which helps looking after them. I spend a lot more time outdoors in the countryside. I think moving house did help. We moved to the middle of nowhere. And I think just having a lot of, green space and being able to leave your front door and just be in a field is a nice feeling.
Josh also spoke to an amazing psychiatrist who gave him some really wonderful information and some life skills. And I think he helped you, didn't he, Josh, really?
Yeah, of course. I went to see a psychiatrist in Bristol and I didn't have much hope before I went because my GPs had been so rubbish. And he said, this isn't your fault, don't you, Josh? And I didn't believe him at first. But he said, if you had cancer, you wouldn't blame yourself. You'd just think about, where you're at and where you need to be and how you're going to get better. But you blame yourself having depression, which I completely did. I thought I'd done something or so massive I couldn't even see it. I thought I deserved to have depression. I thought it was, it's very hard to describe, but I thought I fully deserved the state I found myself in. So when he said, this isn't your fault, you're ill and you need to beat this illness, it completely changed my mindset.
And Josh has talked a lot about not recognising himself and then beginning to recognise himself again. Did you kind of have that experience as well?
I think I thought that the Josh we'd lost, this, our young, outgoing, sparky child, would return after either some medication or speaking to a professional or, learning how to live every day. And I kept waiting for him to be better. And then this is much more about my journey. And of course, it's not about me. This is about Josh. Josh is the person that's ill. But I think it took me a long while to understand that actually this not only may be as good as it gets, but there is a life to be lived with depression. And he's still our wonderful boy. He just has an illness that we need to support and we need to, find ways to give him the happiest life he can possibly lead. And Josh isn't unhappy. That's the thing. I always thought if you were depressed, you were unhappy. You're not. You're ill. And there's a massive difference. He still laughs. He still has some great days. He's still brilliant company. But when his illness, he's in the grip of it, then he has to submit to that. And I think the thing I learned more than anything, Bobby, was that I just need to let him be. I just need to not try and look for the fixed Josh, the better Josh, the new Josh, the improved Josh. I just need to let him be. And actually, that took the foot off the gas for all of us, for Josh, for me, my husband, for everyone. And actually, at that point, I think I started to see a difference in Josh, that he's not better, as I say, but he's great.
Such a lovely way of putting it. And it's true, I think it's perfectly natural as a parent to want an idea of a perfect life for your child. And so whether it's depression or whether it's anything, that's not going to happen. This imaginary version will not come true. But instead, there is such brilliance in the shades of grey, in the things that you overcome. And I'm at a point with depression myself where, as difficult as the same as you, Josh, there can be some incredibly difficult days. But I've learnt enough about managing my mental health that I know so much more about managing my mental health than most people do. And so that's such an asset. And something like what we're going through with the pandemic was a real reminder of all the tools I built up, that so many of my friends that had not experienced mental ill health and had a far more standard 9-to-5 type life than I did were the ones that struggled the most. Whereas I already had a certain affinity for turbulence. I was used to it. And actually, in many ways, maybe there's even something to be said for knowing that the condition that you have that right now is probably the biggest threat to your life, knowing it, understanding it, and how to manage that. Because you can't change it, but you can find a way to live a brilliant life despite it. And in some ways, that feels like an even bigger win.
Absolutely. I certainly feel like I know myself better than most people, I feel.
And there's such power to that. And do you feel like through this experience, you've become even closer?
Yeah. Don't get me wrong. I would rather have not been on this journey. Not that I wanted to remain ignorant and in darkness, but I liked not having to worry about it. I've got to be honest, I liked that life. It was quite nice not to have to look at my child asleep and think, oh, I wonder what he'll do when he grows up. I wonder if he'll be an artist or a musician or a doctor. What will he do? Instead of worrying that he might not stay on the planet. I liked living in some ways in that state of ignorance. But yes, I think I know Josh back to front and inside out. I understand him a lot better. I drive him crackers, but I think that's probably part of the course. And I now know that if he reaches crisis again, which, you know, is a possibility, that he can and must and will reach out. And we'll build a safety net together just to hold him up for as long as he needs. And he's not on his own, even though he felt like he was. He's not. He's absolutely loved. So many people don't have that safety net, and that breaks my heart, because they suffer just like Josh does, but they do alone, because there isn't the funding, there isn't the immediacy of response to people who reach out, even to professionals. And that breaks my heart, because I think sometimes all you need to know is that someone has got your back for when you fall. And so I think we're in the best place we can be.
So lovely to hear. And what I'm hearing from that is that as much as you would never wish this on anybody, if it is the case, you'd always rather know.
Always. Absolutely. 100%. I want to know, because then I can, if not fix it, which was my old response, then I can support him. And sometimes that support, very on in Josh's depression journey, I said, I don't know how to help you. I don't know what to do. And he said, come into my room, open my window, turn my pillow over and bring me a glass of water. And I said to him, oh, what, like you were ill? And he said, Mum, I am ill.
That's so powerful, and it's so true that it's so difficult to admit that as a parent, getting to that point where you can say, I don't know what to do, because you think you should have all the answers, that parents have sold this lie, this perfectionism, that you have to know perfectly how to be a parent, and anything that comes up you have to have the answer for. And no wonder parents feel like they're getting it wrong so commonly.
And I certainly got it wrong, and I feel that the exact opposite. I was a smug mum. I would tell you, hand on heart, that I knew everything about my kids. I knew what they were going through, I knew what their aspirations were, I knew their friends, I ate dinner with them, we went on holiday together, I was doing it all great, I was a smug mum. So this kind of pulled the rug from under me and made me realise that, goodness me, you never know unless you ask, and you never know unless you're talking about it. And that's the thing, you can't assume you know what your kids are going through or people you love are going through. You know, you actually have to ask the questions. And I think one of the healthiest conversations we had was when my husband and I sat Josh down and said, look, we don't know what to do, and we know you don't know what to do, but we're going to figure it out together. In to the best that we can. You know, we won't have a solution for you, Josh, but, you know, we'll figure it out together. And I think that was another really key turning point. And that's where we're at. And we're still figuring it out. And I have a good day with Josh, and Josh is, you know, on top of the world. And I think, oh, you know, this is marvellous. I take such joy from it. And then the next day he can be under a blanket again, with his head covered, non-communicative. And I think, and it just, it's really hard. But again, I just keep repeating, if it's hard for us, it's a million times harder for Josh, because we're not suffering with it. We just live next to it. And that's very, very different.
And Josh, with all that your mum has worked to overcome with her own stigmas and to understand you better, how would you say the support is? Can you reassure her?
Now that she's aware of what I'm going through and, you know, not ignorant to what depression is, it's, you know, it's great. She understands you have to be kind to yourself when suffering depression. I know if I'm having a bad day, if I have to go to bed for a day and sort of just clear my head and sleep it off, I'm happy to do that now. And I know that my parents were there to support me in doing so. I think one thing I've learned on through my journey is you just self-kindness isn't always the easiest thing to practice, but it's required for everyone. So you can't feel guilty, you know, putting yourself first in some ways and just taking a day off from the world.
Yeah. And I feel like in some ways that's quite a British problem, prioritising yourself, acknowledging that sometimes you're the one that needs the help and needs the focus, but you've got to. There are so many times when that's the case. And so we'll start wrapping up there then. So if people want to hear more about your experience and what you've learned along the way, they can read The Boy Between, a book you co-wrote through alternating chapters, if I'm right in thinking, and that comes out on the 1st of November. What would you like to say about it?
It's one of those books that there's no gloringly air-punching moment at the end where we arrive at a place called happy and everyone sits back and pops a cork. That doesn't happen. But it's a very honest, raw account of what it's like to have depression come and live in your house and to take control of your child and to feel absolutely helpless. I was out of answers. And I just hope it gives parents and carers like me a bit of comfort to know that actually it's okay to make mistakes. It doesn't mean you won't get there in the end.
And just like Josh said, it's not just about the person living with it and them feeling alone. You can feel incredibly alone as a carer as well.
Yeah. I thought I should know the answers, Bobby, and I didn't. And I think Josh, has your message is really more about
just holding on and staying in there. Things can and usually do get better.
Mm.
And I think it's a book that, as Mandy said in the past, it's one she wished she hadn't have had to write. It's your first non-fiction book, and it's just a very, you know, real, open, honest account of our lives over the past few years. So
we thought, if we decided if we're going to write it, then we're going to do it completely honestly, or there was no point. And that doesn't always make for comfortable reading for me, certainly. And I'm sure for Josh, it's his life laid bare. And I remember saying to him, you know, if you write this book, if we do this, because we started emailing each other, that's how the book began. And I was asking him questions on what to do. And he started answering me. And before I knew it, you know, we had quite a lot of words. I said, my worry is that, you know, this will label you. You'll be that boy with depression. And he said, Mum, I am that boy with depression. And again, that was...
Yeah, but it's a journey. And I love that honesty you both have about that, that there is no final end point. Mental health is something we all have to work on for life. And it's so incredible to hear how much you've learned. And now that you've got an opportunity to share that with your readers. So yeah, it's very exciting. I very much look forward to reading it. And thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having us, honestly. Thank you and Danielle very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.